Welcome to Water for Fighting, where we discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. It goes to me to say that the last few seasons would have been literally impossible without the support of my two amazing sponsors. So let me take just a second to mention them now. Water for Fighting is brought to you by Resource Environmental Solutions and Sea and Shoreline. RES is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at www.res.us. And of course, Sea and Shoreline. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator in protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at www.cnshoreline.com. All right, on with the show. I'm so excited to introduce this week's guest, Mark Merkelbach. I met Mark exactly 1 year ago, almost precisely 1 year ago, because we're recording here in Marco Island at the Environmental Permitting Summer School. But it wasn't until this year that I really got to learn about the exciting work that he and his team are doing to improve water quality here in Florida. Mark's an engineer and a wetland scientist, and he's the CEO of Green Earth Operations, otherwise known as GEO, and the COO of the Sustainable Water Infrastructure Group, or SWIG. I think he also holds the distinction as the most well-traveled guest to date, and we'll get to why that is in a little bit. But for now, let's get right to it. Welcome to the podcast, Mark.
Thank you, Brett. It's good to be back to Marco Island. This is my third year and was luckily also a presenter. I had the honor of presenting the very last speaker of my section on the very last day, about 11:30 this morning. So very, very prized distinction. Yes,
it is. I mean, it takes a real trooper. And over the years, I guess if you hit like 25, 30 years here, they move you up to like Tuesday or Wednesday so you can get out of the way and then kind of relax the rest of the time.
Right? I'm imagining many more Fridays to come.
If I wasn't doing other things today, I would have come and seen it myself. It's like, but that's kind of everyone, what everyone says, which is they're all, most people are checking out and doing that sort of thing. But I'm sure it was really well done.
It was very well attended. Raphael from Jacobs had mentioned that attendance was doubled from last year. So we were, you know, it was nice to see people stick around. And I think we had a really bunch of cool topics to talk about.
All right. And we've got a lot to talk about here, you know, in this conversation. Really cool stuff to talk about as it relates to your background, your life, your work. But I want to start off with probably the most important item that we have, which is you have three cats.
That's correct.
And a one-eyed, three-toothed Shih Tzu.
Yes.
What's the little survivor's name?
Her name is Button. She's very near and dear to us. She's also a survivor of puppy mills. So we were given to her after she had a stillborn and could no longer bear any more litters. So we inherited her as a pretty damaged orphan dog. And the Shih Tzu species with its flat nose is a pretty tough one on teeth. Mm. And unfortunately, this is a problem that I believe a lot of other Shih Tzu's experience. So we've helped her out, and then she's happy on soft food. So and she is getting along with one eye. So she's pretty relentless.
I was concerned Button's maladies were from the cats. Like he put three cats in a house with a little dog, and then they just go to work on.
No, there's a lot of mutual respect in the household. The cats are a product of COVID. You know, we are a very social family, and during that difficult process that everyone had to go through, my wife and daughter thought it'd be in our best interest to add more family members. So we adopted three, actually it was four cats, to be honest, until one died. And then we need to add some additional animals to the household.
Well, the last time we were together was up in Tallahassee. But obviously, like I said, we're recording down in Marco Island at summer school. Beyond the panel that you sat on today, how did the conference go for you?
This is kind of the most, I think, important conference in networking for anyone that does water projects within the state of Florida. I mean, it's very intense, but pretty much everybody's under the same roof. And the amount of contacts, new associations, it's off the roof. And it, you know, it continues to get better and better with every year that we've attended. So
that's great. I have the same opinion. I agree. All right, well, you know the deal, and I think you know, I explained it to you before. We kind of went through it. I've got some of your background, so it's time to hit like full rewind here and go to the origin story of Mark Merkelbach. Take us back all the way to the outbreak of World War II. Actually, I guess maybe even be like a touch before that, because it changed pretty much the entire nature of your family, right?
Correct. Merkelbach, being German, started with my grandfather, who at 18 or 19 years of age, emigrated to the U.S. right after World War I, and he's that prototypical immigrant that went through Ellis Island, and by himself, too. I guess his parents threw him on a ship and went through Ellis Island and ended up meeting a family up in upstate New York that kind of brought him in. And that was Buffalo, New York, is where he started as a U.S. citizen. And then from that time, he went into medicine, ended up getting his medical degree, and met my grandmother along the way in upstate New York. And then they somehow, I don't know the whole story, but they ended up in New Jersey, where he established his medical practice. And way back when, he was a general surgeon. So he delivered the babies in the town, did the house calls. He did everything. I mean, half the town, in one way or the other, had been serviced by my grandfather. So yeah,
wow.
Pretty interesting.
Where did he go to school? Do you remember?
I do not know.
That's all right.
Yeah.
And on your mom's side of the family, it gets a little more interesting because you're dealing with that side being from Holland, right?
My mom is Dutch, correct.
Right. And this is born during World War II, right?
Yep, she was born, I had to check, 1944. At that time, my grandfather, during the invasion of the Netherlands, was taken as a prisoner. And Germans took him to a BMW tank factory where he was placed in the kitchen. And the story goes that when the war was over, he came back home. He was probably about 100 pounds overweight, while my grandmother and the kids were pretty much eating very meagerly. Wow. And I think she was more horrified by the weight that he gained than seeing him enter the household.
Did they take him, was that tank factory still in Holland, or did they take him back to Germany?
They took him to Germany, and he worked in a BMW tank factory in Germany.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah. It's insane. It seems like it was many generations ago, and these are like lost stories.
Yeah. How did they get to the United States?
Well, I have half my family still in Holland. So my mom, she worked for Honeywell. She was a secretary and came out to the United States as a secretary, and then ended up meeting my dad a blind date.
Really?
Yeah, that's how it all started.
Where did the blind date take place? Was it like at school or just?
It was in New Jersey. My dad was a bachelor. He was a dentist, and it was just through two friends. They kind of linked them up on a blind date, and that's where it all started.
Wow. Yeah, and you mentioned New Jersey a couple of times, and so you were born in New Jersey as well.
Correct. Okay.
Born and raised in New Jersey, where, I mean, we talked about before, you spent pretty much every summer, I think until you said you were like 19 or 20, on the Jersey Shore. And I'm glad we're talking, because at this point, and I said before, it's like everything I needed to know about New Jersey or the Jersey Shore, I thought I'd had, you know, from watching or knowing that show on, was it MTV or something like that, existed. Is it all like that, or just that northern end that you were talking about?
We all wish it was like that. Unfortunately, that is a very small spectrum of what this Jersey Shore is all about. I mean, it's part of my DNA. I mean, we go back, we've had homes out there, and we go back there every year. Even my kids, who are now 18 and 20, when they think of the beach, they think of Jersey Shore. So my hat's off to the MTV program for putting us on the map, but it's not as exciting, yes.
Yeah, and that was Long Beach Island, right, for you, not like, was it Seaside Heights, I think, was the show?
Yeah, Seaside Heights, yeah, that's the island. They're all barrier islands, so we're south of Seaside, so the less boring part, not so crazy there. But yeah, that's been a really important part of my life, and actually it's a really important part of my connection to water, being on that ocean and having those experiences.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you, which is, what was it like? Tell me about a typical summer day for you as, you know, 8-year-old Mark. I'm hanging out at the shore.
50% of the day I'm in the water. That's it. And I still am. I mean, we were kind of attracted to beaches everywhere. I took up surfing a little bit later in my life. And now that's also, while I still can do it, I still love getting out into crazy destinations and getting messed up by waves.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll get to some of those crazy destinations. Is there surfing in New Jersey?
There is. I mean, it's similar to Florida. I mean, it's hurricane. You know, there's waves year round, but when the hurricanes come on off the Atlantic, they create the big swell. So, End of summer into fall is usually the prime wave time. Mm.
Yeah. When I was a teenager, I may or may not have skipped school with some friends once in a while to surf on the East Coast. I grew up on the West Coast of Florida, and you could do a little bit of that, but it wasn't until I got out of the Army and I was in the National Guard and we saw a hurricane coming. So we thought, for once, in your life, maybe get to, surf some waves that were, taller than, 5 or 6 feet. And then I realized that when there's a hurricane and you're in the National Guard, they expect you to go to work. And so I had to turn around and go back.
Where were you stationed?
Mostly in Fort Stewart, Georgia.
Okay.
Either that or some godforsaken desert somewhere. Oh. So back to you. How long is that, are the barrier islands for New Jersey?
Long Beach Island's 18 miles. They vary. They're a little bit longer up north. Yeah, from tip to tip in LBI, it's 18. They do a kind of a quasi-marathon every fall. So, And, they're all connected by bridges, and they got the intercoastal. I mean, you could, in theory, take the intercoastal in Jersey and make your way all the way down to Florida. Yeah.
We were talking before we recorded about your dad and, what facilitated your ability to spend all those awesome summers at the shore. He was a dentist, right?
He was a dentist, but he was also a big outdoorsman. He hunted, and fishing was also, I did a ton of fishing, still try to get out when I can, but I've multiple connections to water through just recreating and whatnot.
Yeah, is that like out in the Atlantic, or is there someplace in the Garden State, part of the Garden State, where you would go?
Well, we had boats growing up, so the bay and get out into the ocean. Jersey even has trout fishing. That would be probably news to lots of folks, but yes. Pretty decent trout fishing. And then during the summers, we'd also get up into the Adirondacks for 2 weeks. We did that for a while, so we both freshwater and saltwater experiences.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to ask, like you said, your dad was an outdoorsman, and I was like, well, you've got kind of a pedigree of sorts, for medicine, given, grandparents and your dad, but you end up going a different way, obviously, as a career. When did that start? At what point when you were growing up did you say to yourself, I want to do stuff related to the outdoors for a living?
I think it happened in the Adirondacks. I think I love immersing myself in nature, and that was my drive. I always had this affinity to be in water. The Adirondacks are really unique landscape. Half of it's protected. It's within a park system, and it's just something that I wanted to be a part and I wanted to protect and find opportunities to, figure out where my role would fit within that.
Did you have any idea? I guess maybe did you wait for college? You went to the University of Vermont, right?
I went straight looking at environmental programs from the get-go. So I knew that was the direction, and I felt water was going to be one of the ways of getting in there. But I went through just an environmental studies at University of Vermont and UVM. Shout out to those catamounts out there. Burlington's amazing. Little town on Lake Champlain, you got the mountains right in the background. So, during the summer or winter, there's always something to do outside.
And somewhere in there, because you'll probably have to go back to the shore here for me, and historically speaking, it's like, but somewhere in there, you met your wife. Where on that timeline was that? Because I think you met on the shore, right?
Well, it's very logical. It's at a German restaurant on the Jersey Shore. That's where we met. Yes. Yeah. So she was a waitress and I was a line cook. It took several years of me to get her attention, and then eventually I did get her attention, and that's where it all started. Yes.
And you said that her dad was an architect, and it seemed like she went to architecture school, right?
Yep.
Was that in Vermont as well, or did that end up being somewhere else?
Yep. So her dad was an architect out of Washington, D.C., and her father was actually her grandfather was an architectural model builder, so he had this crazy model shop of building all these scale models to even Louis Kahn in Philadelphia, who very famous architect. So she had all these designers in her households. She ended up going to Smith in Massachusetts. They didn't have an architecture program, so she ended up taking some classes at Columbia. And then ultimately, after she graduated, she got into the Graduate School of Architecture at University of Washington.
Hmm. All right, let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. When I say the names Andrew, Ian, Irma, and Michael, what immediately enters your mind? If you answered hurricanes, congratulations, you're a Floridian. We all know that hurricanes bring devastating wind, rain, and storm surge. What you may not already know is that my friends at Sea and Shoreline are the leading innovators in the quest to mitigate the destructive wave energy of storm surges with their patented wave attenuation devices, or WADs. Not only can WADs protect against the effects of storm surge, they can also protect our beaches and shorelines from the massive erosion events that tropical storms and hurricanes bring. In fact, WADs have been shown to increase shoreline accretion. That's right, their technology can help build shorelines. Sea and Shoreline is committed to protecting and preserving Florida's communities and coastlines because they are Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to protect your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, let's get back to the episode. And when I introduced you, I called you well-traveled. And I'm going to consider kind of that not necessarily Vermont, because it's not that far away from where you grew up. But we'll start with that going to the University of Washington, the Seattle area, as kind of maybe the catalyst point for, you know, the definition of well-traveled. And the reason I say that about you is because it includes not just Washington State, but I've got India, Mexico, Haiti, and then culminating in you starting and running a business in China for about a decade. So I'm going to let you walk me through your path through those places and some of the really cool things you did. Because, I mean, some of it's very interesting, you know, some of the little side trips that you did to do, as you described, that kind of design build thing. So walk me through that a bit from the time that y'all got to Washington.
Well, the first two destinations, India and Mexico, that started at University of Washington. So I also went to grad school at University of Washington, go Huskies, and through their engineering program. And I was involved also with my wife in these design build programs. So our first program, we spent almost 4 months in India, and we were down in South India. I was brought on as kind of on the engineering side to kind of work on wastewater systems in really rural areas. And then she and a host of other architecture students and landscape architects worked to design a student like youth hostel in a crazy town called Oroville. And Oroville is a world community sponsored by the UN. It's still there. They have a big golden globe called the Matramandir where people go to meditate. Highly recommend checking it out on the site, but it's probably not your prototypical town in India, but it's down south by Pondicherry, which is an old French colony. So it was a profound experience, and I mean, it blew your senses living in India, and we pretty much traveled throughout southern India.
Tell me why you did that. Was it just for the experience? Did you have this wanderlust? Was it philanthropic in terms of, you know, how you saw it or what?
I think I'm all into experiences, and India actually was more overwhelming than I could even imagine, and that was in the early 2000s. And then at that time, my wife, then girlfriend, she was already going, so it was just a great opportunity to get out there. Actually took a sabbatical. I was actually a consultant at that time at an environmental consulting firm. So it was very fortunate to be able to take that time off and actually just be out there as a designer and also as a laborer. And it was an amazing experience.
Was that before or after you finished grad school, or was that during somehow?
It was actually before. Okay. And that India experience was actually... That basically pushed me to go to grad school, because I really didn't have, at that point, I had a ecology background, but I didn't actually really have any formal education in engineering. And I think that kind of opened up my eyes as far as getting more tools to actually help in the design process. And yeah, that kind of helped set that course.
Was that kind of always, was that philosophically how you approached, you know, learning or what you want to do anyway, which is like, how do I do the things that are necessary to do this thing that I want to accomplish? Is that kind of the thought process?
Yeah, I'm all about collaborating, but I also like to build a lot of my own tools. And one thing that I started out as a wetland ecologist and also doing restoration works, being that water's a main driver, you got to know how to be able to design water. You need to know about flow rates and forces. And it just became pretty apparent that if I really wanted to really, you know, take advantage and be a real restoration practitioner, I wanted to have both of those backgrounds.
That makes sense. And so you go to graduate school after India.
After India, and then while in graduate school, went and did another design build down in Mexico, mm-hmm. also with my wife. So we were then, at that point, we were teaching assistants. So we started at students in India and then moved up the ladder where luckily we were able to get part of our cost paid for through the program. Same deal. She was working with the architects. I was working with the engineers. And, you know, we kind of helped, did something similar to what we did in India. We built a facility, actually it was a medical facility for low-income folks. And again, you're working with the locals mm-hmm. and incredibly immersive experience. And you're kind of off the beaten path. So, yeah.
Yeah, what part of Mexico is that then?
Cuernavaca. I'm glad I remembered it. So Cuernavaca, interesting town. One of the great conquistadors had a palace there, and I'm blanking on his name, but there, a lot of history. Diego Rivera, the famed artist, he had these amazing murals. So a lot of rich history, and it's about an hour and a half south of Mexico City.
Okay. Where did you end up going to Haiti? Because I think I had Haiti as well as on your list of places where
I went to Haiti when I was working with an environmental consulting firm in Seattle, and I think probably something, and that was after India and after Mexico. So I, you know, they knew my kind of hunger for unique destinations, and Haiti was equally unique, and it's a country that really has never been given any breaks. And there's a great book by Paul Farmer called, I believe it's Mountains to Mountains. And that just talks about just the challenges of getting basic medical aid to folks. But it also provides that framework of all of these, not hills, but mountains, each person needs to overcome just to survive in that country. We were asked to support Seattle University, which had existing relationships with some charities down in Haiti, and we were using our engineering resources to help farmers within a floodplain. It was called the Moustique floodplain in northwest Haiti, to basically help improve and reduce flooding. Let these folks harvest or grow and harvest plantains, and you know, help kind of rejuvenate that local economy.
Do you ever get a chance through all of these places in terms, you know, India to Mexico, Haiti, to go back ever, like after it's done, maybe a year, maybe a couple of years, you know, later, to just to kind of see it in use?
I have not been back to India, and I've seen photos. So the facility we have is still there. It's up and running. I've been to Haiti 3 times. The issue is we're building the baseline to allow them to get funding. And luckily, a lot of the work we did in Haiti allowed them to get funding to create these diversion channels, avoid flooding. Like, mm-hmm. this is an interesting fact point. Plantains take 9 months to grow. So once a flood hits the floodplain and the plant falls down, it basically will not yield any plantains. So they have to basically reset and wait another 9 months.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine that even if we're able to minimize, you know, occurrences of flooding minimally, and just giving people that chance to get some of that fruit to go to market, it's huge.
All right, let's move to the big one, because it's the one that most intrigues me in terms of like choices you're making. But it sounds to me like the choice making is, hey, here's a crazy place to go do a thing. Let's call Mark because he'll go anywhere to work. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise. Like, but you ended up starting a business, and that was GEO. Tell me what GEO is again.
GEO is environmental consulting firm, Green Earth Operations.
Yeah.
And GEO actually, and I believe I mentioned this in another podcast I did with you, is mm-hmm. my wife has always been a sole owner of her little architectural business. And I had been running kind of an international group within a former consulting firm. And she just is like, you know, it's just time for you to basically leave the mothership and start your own mm-hmm. entity. And luckily, you know, that really helped me. And I think it also is part of the reason why we're here in Marco with my other company, Swig, is kind of got that entrepreneurial itch going. I started working on developing mitigation banks. So I did mitigation banks in Washington State, also worked to certify one up in Alaska. And so these are big projects, had big restoration components, and it just around that time, around 2006, 2007, China had these huge initiatives for rebuilding cities with substantial park infrastructure. They basically wanted to build like new green lungs or the kidneys of the city, and a lot of that had to deal with wetlands. And Fortunately, I was able to link up with some well-known landscape architecture firms based out of San Francisco, and they need folks that had experience with wetlands and hydrology, building habitat, and you know how to basically take these concepts and actually being able to bring them to life. And so that was a journey that ended up lasting for almost 10 years. And it started with the one trip, but you know, it was a whirlwind being surrounded by interpreters and, you know, working with a lot of government entities, helping kind of elevate, helping teach them a little bit about our approach as how we would in the States, and then trying to inject that type of thinking into their projects.
I assume that the reception to that was good at the time. I mean, you wouldn't have done it for 10 years if you got there and they say, well, no, thanks, we're going to...
No, we were introducing new ideas, and there wasn't a lot of local experience at that point in time. So, and that was part of the reason why I think we made a lot of traction. I mean, we were injecting new ideas. You know, we were really helping people understand what diversity meant, what habitat structure is. China at that time was concrete wall, lawn, and a couple of trees. Nothing that a bird would ever want to live in. And we ended up building, for instance, in the city of Ningbo, worked with SWA, and when we worked to design the eco corridor. It's like 4 kilometers long now. It's half a kilometer wide. You look at it on a Google Earth map, and it's a forest within a city. It's unbelievable. And it's like it has its own microclimate. It's where all the birds hang out, and it's like a little mini jungle amidst, you know, 10 million people. It's pretty profound. For those big scale projects, number one, it was mostly they asked landscape architects to do the design work. And at that point, landscape architects at that point had a deficit in understanding just basic ecological principles, soil hydrology. And that's in the States. Over in China, I think it was even more so. I mean, it was all about aesthetics and not really understanding about the biotic and abiotic processes. I mean, now you go to LA schools, I mean, it's injected into everything. This is a theory I have in China, because everything's driven by water. And from a lot of my employees, so I had hired master's students through UW, and they were Chinese and Taiwanese, and a lot of them never swam. And they told me anecdotally through stories that, you know, when they grew up, number one, you always boiled water. You never even got near rivers or ponds because, frankly, they were polluted. When you're a kid and you're told by your grandmother and your mom to stay away, you don't swim, you basically, there's this disassociation with water. And for me, having been fortunate to be around it and in it my entire, you know, as a child, you know, that gravitated toward me in China. I think it almost, and this is my personal, from my experiences, they never had that connection. And I think that led to, you know, not such a great emphasis on focusing on building habitat,
right,
water quality. So my two cents.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm curious, and it's been a while, and so I'm not positive it still stands. Like, but at some point, I was reading maybe National Geographic or something like that some years ago, and it talked about the 10 most polluted rivers in the world, and 7 of them were in Asia, and I think 3 or so were in China. The others were in India, you know, and then you had a few in Africa. And so when you look at that, it's like, is it still that way? I mean, you were there at least near enough to the present to maybe have an opinion. It's like, were the things that you were doing also translate to things like that when you talk about, you know, pollution and waste in those water bodies?
You know, it's, yeah, the density and the urban footprint in China is well, India also has similar issues, but I just think that it's a tragedy of the commons. There's almost no amount of infrastructure you could possibly put in place to basically be able to absorb the tens of million of people you have in these kind of third tier cities. They're not even, you know, there's areas the size of New York, but they're on lesser levels. So they're an amazingly resilient people and population, and you know, they are taking a big focus and emphasis on making water a priority, because I mean, as we know here in Florida, you know, water is kind of the backbone of this economy. And in China, you know, having safe access to water, I think that they're definitely, I have no doubt they are going to be making significant improvements. It's just that you talk about a big mountain you need to overcome. You've had centuries of development in these areas, making it very difficult to get the infrastructure needed to make these real improvements.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation. You mentioned before that without your experience in China, that you wouldn't be who you are today with the company that you have today in terms of not just Geo, but also SWG. What is it that was a part of your experience or the work that you did while you were still in China? I know that, and I want you to talk about why you left. It's like, but leading up to that, tell me about the experience that translated into kind of this new catalyst for your career.
So one of the unique aspects of China is that I never was involved in a permit. Mm-hmm. And we were able, collectively, our design teams were able to come up with ideas and concepts that they would be willing just to fund. They are big risk takers because I credit them. I mean, a lot of the work we're doing here in Florida in these nutrient removal systems is based on the very work we did in China by experimenting with how do you filter water, come up with really low-tech ways of, you know, taking black water and turning it to gray water. That was kind of our R&D background, and I credit our clients for taking those risks and you know, trying to really push the envelope without a permit.
So walk me then through that transition between China, the geo work, and then the creation of SWG, and that path that leads you to sit in front of me a year ago, you know, down here talking about what you were up to.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was doing the work in China, I was commuting from Seattle. So, you know, after a million plus miles, it ended up that after 10 years, the Chinese work environment really wasn't hospitable to foreign consultants anymore. I think for me, I think I overstayed my welcome in a sense of people now knew the type of projects we were designing. We now had public documents out there. There was a little bit of cut and paste where all of a sudden I'd find my designs on a project I'd never worked on. You know, in China, I think that the local designers, they also, you know, they understood that they could play a role in doing this work at, frankly, much cheaper rates. Mm-hmm. And consultants don't really get paid. The contractors get paid. So the money's in construction, not in design. Mm-hmm. So the writing was on the wall that we really did not have a lot more runway, and I needed as an owner to basically pretty much pull out almost 100% and then redirect our efforts, starting with, you know, building up a client base on the West Coast through my firm Green Earth Operations.
Hmm. All right. So then talk me through, and folks, I encourage you to listen to obviously the Florida Specifier podcast, and Ryan Matthews and myself talk to Mark a bit about that. And I want to cover some of that, but I want you to talk about more from a personal, professional standpoint of you starting a new business called SWG, and with the amount of focus that you have in Florida, why you chose Florida and how you started that business.
So SWG was formed on relationships with two partners. One is Jerome Ryan. So Jerome was a long-term client. So I developed two mitigation banks for Jerome, both in Washington State and Alaska. So we had over 10 years of history together. Bill Lucas, who actually at that time was my employee, Bill also had a PhD and had been working in the stormwater field forever. And, you know, he had some really interesting IP on how to remove phosphorus using these different media blends. And we were playing around with that in China for a little bit. Well, around that time, Jerome had been working for a land conservancy group in Florida. So he was looking for land deals, but around that time, and this was around 2016, 2017, water was everywhere. His firm, that wasn't their focus. Their focus was acquiring land. And through some conversations, you know, the dots just connected that Bill and I had been working, we had some pretty cool technology. Florida was being really progressive and actually was putting a lot of dollars on the table to improve their waterways. And we just decided that it's just a golden opportunity. Let's invest in ourselves. Let's bring this technology to the forefront. And looking at the U.S., Florida, no doubt, was the place where we thought we would have the best opportunity to get projects in the ground and grow.
And so, I mean, yeah, what did that look like at the time? This is me not knowing your business asking, is like, were you really, at this point, first to market in some of the, you said you were playing around with the chemistry a bit. It's like where you came up with a product that you believe is going to solve these problems. Was there anyone doing it at the time? What does the competition look like when you start? And then what does it look like now?
I'll take a step back, is that we first started by building a wet laboratory in Bill Lucas's basement up in Pennsylvania. So Bill converted his basement into a lab. Bill, Jerome and I and Bill, we all self-funded it. And we basically started collecting our own data sets, looking at both phosphorus and nitrogen removal. We also had a relationship at that time with the North Florida Land Trust. So, I mean, like this conference, it's all about networks. Mm-hmm. And so we worked with the Land Trust, who actually made the initial introductions to the St. John's Water Management District. They also introduced us to the City of Jacksonville, who are two entities which had nutrient problems. And they were also looking at innovative ways of being able to remove nutrients. So that's kind of where it started. It started with North Florida Land Trust, and then it actually was the public RFP process, where we were fortunate to basically build a team and being able to execute our first project, which is called Doctor's Lake, which is a phosphorus removal system. And that was awarded in around 2018, and we built it during COVID. Actually, yeah, amazing that we got built during COVID, and then we turned the switch on in 2020.
Yeah, and you mentioned, and we finally got to, probably my fault more than anything, is like we got to what it is that the thing it is that you does, which is remove phosphorus, from that facility. How do you do it?
The first thing was a function of looking what are people currently doing, and we were, being that we had kind of a stormwater background, we already had experience in typical LID, using bioretention soils to treat stormwater, and those are really simple mixes, but with 50% removal rates. The research that Bill did showed that we could actually remove phosphorus at these really high levels, plus 90%, and you're not seeing a lot of that with these kind of passive media systems. And then we looked at treatment wetlands, which required just way too much land area, especially in urban areas. And so that was at least giving us an indication that we had something here. So we have a patent, and it starts with water treatment residuals. So that's no secret. Mm-hmm. And water treatment residuals, they're produced at drinking water treatment plants, and it's typical, it's from alum dosing. And the alum creates a sludge. And then that sludge, it's sometimes land applied, other times it's actually just disposed of at a landfill. We have developed a process where we take that residual and we reprocess it, and then we blend it with a couple other proprietary ingredients to create a filter product, which it looks like a sandy granular substance, but it has a very high affinity to remove phosphorus. Mm-hmm. Phosphorus is negatively charged. Our product has a very high positive charge. So you have that attraction. So think of all these balls of this media. So the phosphorus is binding to the exterior, and then in a short period of time, it translocates. It actually becomes bound to this particle. Mm-hmm. So it's immobile. And it's pretty unique because it doesn't leach. And it also has a really long lifetime to continue to replicate these processes. So that's why our product can last for 20 to 25 years before you need to replace it.
How do you deploy it at that Fleming Island project site?
That site was version 1.0, and we ended up making our media at the abandoned runways down at Green Cove Springs. We worked with a subcontractor who had never made or blended media in his life. And while COVID was going on, we were pretty much through teams working with them on adding the additives and blending it. It's all non-toxic also. That's an important thing. So this, we're not adding chemicals. We're basically just taking raw products and creating a blend. So we actually blended it on the runway and then did the install. And the install was on a Clay County Utility Authority wastewater treatment plant. So we're receiving their treated effluent, which still had fairly high levels of phosphorus, and then we basically push it into our system. And you know, if you think of it, I think of it as a layer cake. So you've got about 16 inches of our engineered media underneath a gravel under drain. So we're basically spreading water over the surface, and it's covered with plants. Mm. Plants are there to mainly provide porosity. We want those roots to basically get in there and create structure so the media doesn't compress. And we also want those plants, then those roots create macropores to help with high infiltration rates. And so we're spreading the water, we're dosing it, and this process happens 24/7.
And so from Project 1.0, what does it look like in terms of how you grow that business? What is the model for you? Is it all wastewater treatment facilities? What are you looking at? We talked about Black Creek before. We talked about color removal, which I think is fascinating. How wide does the band work for the things that you can accomplish with the products that you're using?
Well, the business model starts with never stopping to innovate. So we're now kind of in a we're in like generation 4 and 5 of our media blend. So since 2020, we set up our own wet laboratory up in Orange Park, where we've got about 20 columns even right now. We are constantly testing new blends and finding ways of getting better performance, and also at the end of the day, being able to provide a more affordable product. So that's the first thing. So everything that we're doing is backed by very substantial and robust data sets. And then as far as the market, our space is kind of interesting space, because you've got wastewater treatment plants that can take really high pollutant loads and get it low. We then can go after those low loads and get them even lower. Mm. And that is especially important with a lot of these ecosystem restoration projects, where they're really trying to hit these really low baseline numbers, right, which a lot of conventional technology, it's just very expensive to go that route. So that's the space we fit, both with phosphorus, and we're also now have developed a similar component with layers of media where we can also remove nitrogen. So phosphorus and nitrogen are really the big drivers to water impairments throughout the state.
Right.
And then last but not least, the district, St. John's District, reached out to us many years ago about, can we remove tannins? And that was unknown to us. And it ends up that we did some bench testing, got some positive results, ended up doing actually quite a bit, a lot more work, and work with CDM Smith, where we did extensive piloting and bench testing of these different blends to basically determine long-term removal performance. Hmm. And through that process, we were able to show that we have a product that can meet a 9 to 10 year lifetime before you would have to start replacing sections. And that's to meet these color removal goals.
And how much is that? Just, I mean, in terms of, you know, when it comes to phosphorus or nitrogen or something like that, there's always, you know, there's a percentage or a pound or something like that. What is the degree that one works in when you talk about color change?
So color change is called the PCU, platinum cobalt unit. Mm-hmm. And so that's a measure of color. I'll talk about the project. It's the Black Creek Water Resource Development Project, in which they are piping water from Black Creek watershed down to Keystone Heights. So it's a 17-mile pipeline, and it's an aquifer recharge project. So it's restoring these water flows into the lakes, Lake Brooklyn and other lakes that unfortunately have had these receding water levels, docks to nowhere. And it happens to be in a clear water aquatic system. And so the EPA was requiring that you have to meet a color requirement. You can't just put this tannin-laden water into this clear water system. So the threshold's 40 PCUs. So Black Creek water ranges from 100 to 400.
Wow.
There's a lot of variability. So, you know, the goal is for us to basically treat up to 10 million gallons into a 13 acre footprint and basically be able to sustain color that's below 40 PCUs into this clear creek system. So everything's monitored. We're very confident, and through the data and through our continuing testing, we know we have a solution that can meet these goals.
That's great. All right, everyone has to do it. We're going to get to the section where I basically ask you the question I ask everybody. But first, let me ask you first, how can people get in touch with you if they want to learn more about how you can help them?
Well, first of all, go to our website, www.swig-llc.com. There you can basically get all the contact information. You know, Vince Siebold is our director of operations. Vince is a pretty familiar face here in Florida. He's been a public servant through DEP and St. John's. We're attending most of the conferences these days. So we are continuing to network and build these relationships with folks that need solutions.
And I'll throw some, all that stuff up on the episode notes for this recording. So make sure you check that out if you're listening. All right. So as you take a look back at your career so far, is there something or some things that you might have approached differently? I'm guessing it might involve some work in China, but it may be, maybe elsewhere. What do you think about that?
It's weird because there's so many shared experiences. I don't think I have many regrets. Maybe I would have liked to potentially have pulled out of China a little bit sooner. So maybe there was some denial that whole avenue of work would have ended up evaporating on us. But I feel that, in life, you gotta basically take the highs and the lows, and the lows help you make better informed decisions moving forward. So Florida is I'm still a newbie to this state, and I really value my relationships with folks like you and some other folks to give us guidance to help us, make good decisions and really figure out what are the best strategies and how can we really make a difference and also, grow a business here in Florida.
What professional accomplishment are you most proud of so far?
That is very great. That's an interesting question. I'll be honest, I'm really proud of the Ningbo Eco Corridor, because it's pretty easy to see in Google Earth, so you don't really have to go and magnify too much. I mean, I think that was a project that I'm very fortunate and very proud to have been a part of. And I'll tell you what, I'm actually, and this is something that we really didn't talk about, but I'm really proud to basically have proven the value of the Doctors Lake project. I mean, it's 4 years old now. It's directly monitored. We have 4 years of daily water tests. I mean, it's probably one of the most monitored projects, and I think that people wanted to see the results, wanted to see the longevity, and I think now we're at the point where we're proven. We're it's not a pilot; it's full scale, and I do think that this is just I'm really just proud of us figuring it out. Mm-hmm. We just actually finished a media production facility in Mount Dora, so we were making media on a runway with track hose and pretty coarse equipment. We now have got a state-of-the-art facility in Mount Dora that is making it to, some guy said, it's prescription grades, where we can dial in the exact particle size, the diameters and everything. So, I mean, and then we've been able to find amazing people in the state that believe in the company, they believe in our vision and wanting to push these nature-based passive systems, and kind of proven to people that they're real. This is John Steverson, who has guided us through this state. He says he doesn't work with snake oil salesmen. and I think we finally have kind of turned the curve and have proven that we can provide a tool to the state. And we have something that is, I think it's going to help make a real difference.
Are you optimistic about the future of the environment and natural systems in Florida? And if so, why? Or if not, why?
I don't think we have any other choice. And I think that humanity, if you look at history, you know, once you get pressed in a corner and there's enough forces, I think that collectively we all eventually come together and figuring out ways and using our innovation to overcome huge challenges. And I think Florida is, it's getting there. I think the governor, to his credit, is really giving tools and resources to this state. And folks really are getting projects in the ground. And I think that I was listening to Tracy Picone earlier today about, you know, they have 60,000 acres of STAs. I mean, it's unbelievable what they're doing down in mm-hmm. South Florida. And, you know, we're trying to undo some of our early engineering feats of nature and learning from our past mistakes. And I think that's I do see progress, and I am optimistic about our future.
What advice would you give to young people who are either entering or have interest in entering the environmental field?
I would take a few years off, meaning I would not go directly into grad school. I think I was 4 or 5 years after I went back to grad school. So I ended up working in the real world. Unfortunately, I was able to travel. I think that really helped me focus to exactly what my goals wanted to be, instead of just becoming a student and getting another degree. I think it made me more hungry. So I encourage folks to get those experiences, get those jobs, which, you know, early on probably they're not so fancy and whatnot, but it really, I think it will help inform them and really help them focus to make the best if they end up going to a graduate degree.
I think that's a good place to wrap then. Mark Merkelbach, thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate it. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. And thank you once again to Rez and Sea and Shoreline for making it possible. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod, and you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com. Send me your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he had to work with, and to David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer.